History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we know they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it, willing to ask a few questions, and willing to invest a little time to listen as memories from long ago add to our perspective in the here and now. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, what we find is that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend, we enter a new month, and you may hear more than your fair share of April Fool's Day pranks, but what was happening in the Pacific 78 years ago was no laughing matter. April 1st, 1945 marked the beginning of the Battle of Okinawa. Nearly 3 months and more than 50,000 American casualties later, the island would be secured in what would become the last major land battle of World War II. Today, we're going to glean perspective from three men whose lives were forever changed by their time on Okinawa, three men who all brought some special souvenirs home from the island, items that represented the significance of the battle, the price paid to liberate the island, and also the reality of what war meant for civilians. We're going to start with an 18-year-old who was one of the first ashore on Okinawa 78 years ago this weekend with Navy Beach Party 62. George Chrisman.
Easter Sunday, we climbed out of the cargo ship, lounged the cargo nets, loaded ourselves onto the Amtraks because they weren't sure what the beach was. We get into the beach with the ship. So we went on the Amtraks. We gathered out. It was still dark. Gathered around a big circle. We had Easter sunrise service there with the chaplain. And after the chaplain had the Easter sunrise service, we left for the beach. And about that time, my commander, the beach master, had his radio and all the big ships started shelling the beach where we were going to land to clear it further. And then as soon as we got near the beach, stopped that shelling, and the Amtrak continued on. The Army went ashore. About the third wave, we went ashore, dug our foxholes, set up the radio communications and beach markers, and started unloading ships. Very scary.
I would imagine so, and a pretty important role in that invasion. But you said the first thing you guys did was you had an Easter sunrise service. The right. Chaplain led the way with that. Do you remember anything about what was said there or what that meant to you to start that day that way?
Nope. Just scary.
Yeah. I imagine you felt like you were going to need some extra protection.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And so you talk about the beachmaster and this landing party. So basically your guy's job was to get there first and set up some kind of organization so all these waves and waves and waves of troops coming ashore would be organized and going in the right direction.
Right.
Is that right?
The beachmaster's job is to direct that landing.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a pretty dangerous job, too, though.
Well, yes, it is.
Did you guys come under enemy fire?
Yes. We had a lot of Japanese up there in the mountains that were shooting at us.
Uh-huh. So what did you do?
Duck.
You had a foxhole and you...
Yeah, but the foxhole was only about a foot deep.
That doesn't do much good.
Because you had the hard pan.
Uh-huh.
So you dug whatever you could, and you lay down in there, and then it rained, and we got full of water, and didn't worry about the water. Just get down in there.
So what goes through your mind when you're in that foxhole, and you still hear these rounds going off around you?
Hope you live for the next day. And when we that first day, we looked up there, and it was a little house about, 50 yards or 100 yards away. They were flying the Japanese flag.
Mm-hmm.
So about three of us went up there, and first we called in for an American flag to be sent in. They sent the flag in. When we got the flag, we went over took the flagpole down. It's one of those flagpoles where you pull a pin out and the whole pole comes down.
Mm-hmm.
Then we took the flag down. We put the American flag up and put the flag back, pole back up. And that little house that was there, we didn't know it at the time, but there was a guy up on the roof was shooting at people. So eventually... After we had the American flag up, we went up there with a couple of hand grenades and blew up the whole building. And he was down on the ground, dead. No,
but you didn't
shot.
Know he was there when you were taking the flag.
No.
He could have killed you.
Oh, yeah. And then after I took the flag down, I put the flag in my pocket. You got those jumbo pockets, and I put it in my pocket. When I got back on the ship 4 days later, I still had this flag.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home, I put it in my treasure chest, and my daughter was going through my stuff for 4 or 5 years. Well, it's been about 10 years now. And she found this flag. Said, "What's this flag, Dad?" And I told her. I said, "That's the one we took off a flagpole in Okinawa." And so I folded it up and put it away, and I still got the flag now.
And I imagine there were a few American servicemen, whether they were Navy like you or Army or Marines or even Army Air Corps, that ended up on Okinawa, because that was a long, drawn-out battle over a lot of territory. There are probably quite a few of them that ended up bringing a flag of some kind back. But my guess is yours might be the first one. Could anyone have grabbed the flag on Okinawa before you did?
Any one of the three that took it down. I cut it off because it was tied onto the pole.
Yes, but so there were three of you, but there was only one flag.
Right.
So you got that flag. And I'm just saying, timeline-wise, because this is the first day of the battle, and you're in there early on, you were probably the first American to take a Japanese flag on Okinawa.
Right.
What was the significance of that for you, to cut down this Japanese flag, not just to take it for yourself, but to put up in its place the Stars and Stripes?
That was amazing. A lot of memories go by there. I look back at that flag and salute it and say, "Oh, there's my flag.
Mm-hmm.
That's our country."
And there was a long way to go in that battle.
Oh, yes. 10,000 a day was being killed.
And you'd be back on the ship for most of it.
Yeah.
But you did see some. So the first day on Okinawa, you're one of the first in. You take this flag. Still the Japanese are firing on you guys. How long did that day feel?
Seemed like it never ended.
Yeah?
Especially about dusk. When it got dusk, it was about 50 Japanese planes coming over. Those kamikaze pilots. Oh, they just blackened the sky. And here they come, and you just jump in your dive into your foxhole. And these planes were... terrible noise, and they couldn't get any planes off because it was just about dusk, and they didn't get any planes off, so all the ships at sea were firing.
So you have a pretty good seat for this show.
Yeah.
The ships are close enough to shore that you can see them.
Oh, yeah.
And you see the kamikazes attacking them. Is that a bit of a helpless feeling? Do you find yourself cheering?
Nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Just pray that you don't get hit.
Yeah, and pray those guys out on the ships are safe.
Because they've got some of those planes were hitting right near the beach, blowing up.
Mm-hmm. Did you lose any friends that day?
No. Luckily, we were on the beach and the army was moving ahead.
Uh-huh.
We had friends that got shot, but that's about it.
Uh-huh.
I got hit one time in my hand, but that's a small shell. You know, a small arm, so...
It was that day or
reached
no?
Out, yeah. Reach down, pull it out with your teeth because it burns. It burns like it's on fire.
Okay. You're saying that like it's not a big deal, but the rest of us, for the most part, have not been in these kind of situations. So you're 18 years old. You're on the beach on the first day of one of the biggest battles in the history of the world, and a bullet hits you?
Yep. You're scared.
So you're trying to direct troops who are still coming into shore?
Yeah, and call for whatever supplies they needed.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a pretty chaotic scene. It's probably just go, go, go.
It is go, go, go. You don't sleep for 3 or 4 days.
Literally.
You're up all night long calling the radio. And you might nap, but that's about it.
As troops come ashore, they keep moving inland, but you're staying there to keep things moving and coordinate what's happening. But in that job, you're on the radio, and did you know people were shooting at you, or did you just feel it out of nowhere?
You could hear them.
You could hear guns going off.
Yeah, the Japanese are... They had the cliff up there. It was mountains. And they had dug in big shelters up on the cliffs. And they had trails. And they packed the dead bodies. They packed in front as a guard.
Uh-huh.
So they were looking over the dead bodies. And we ended up going up there and with hand grenades and sneaking up there and throwing the hand grenade in the cave that they had built so it would be, wouldn't be any more small arm fire.
But before that, you actually get hit in the hand.
Yeah. We didn't worry about that.
Well,
just a small one.
Well, what did it feel like? How did you realize what had happened?
It just burned like somebody hit you with a hot coals.
And you look down at your hand, and what do you see?
It was right here in the wrist.
Your left wrist.
You just reach in there, and nothing else to grab, and so you bite on it, spit it out, and burn your lips. And you do what you have to.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I'm picturing this. And again, you're talking about this so mundanely, like this is something that just happens. But you have a bullet that lodges in your wrist, a hot piece of metal.
Yeah.
And you took your teeth and bit in and got it out of there.
Yeah.
You'd never done that before.
Nope. We've been trained, though, for first-line medics because there's no doctors on there.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody gets shot or a shrapnel or whatever, you can do a minor incision and take it out. If they break a bone, you feel with it.
Uh-huh.
And you find out what's the matter, and then you tape it up. Most of those guys, I don't care. I'm going to go on. Get me well, and I'm going. My job is to fight. Give me my rifle.
So you'd been trained to render first aid if people were injured around you. But is that how you were trained to do it, to bite a bullet out of somebody?
No, you just do what you have to.
So when it hits you, you go ahead and you clamp down on the bullet and pull it out of there and spit it out naturally. Didn't think about saving it for your kids?
Nope.
You weren't thinking about ever being married or having kids at that point.
Saving your life. Your life is more important. Get it out of there.
So what did it look like after you took the bullet out of there? I imagine there's some blood, right?
Yeah, there was blood and it was sore. You push it back together as much as you can and put a bandage over it.
Uh-huh. You had to do that all by yourself?
Yeah. Put a little sulfamaldehyde in it and bandage it up.
Well, just the fact that you got hit in the wrist, that's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think it's pretty close to the old heart, but it's only a small arms, you know, like a .22 bullet.
Well,
so if it hits a bone, it's going to just smush her. It's not going to be like a big 30-30 rifles that the Army was using.
Well, still, if it's in the right spot.
Oh, yeah.
That could be it for you.
The neck, the head.
Yeah. So you said you were scared before that happened.
And you're scared after.
More scared?
Oh, yeah.
And you have to keep doing your job.
You do your job.
And you said you guys didn't sleep that whole 4 days you were there?
You nap once in a while, but the minute you go to sleep, there's something going on, blowing up someplace.
How did you do that? What do you think happened inside of you to enable you to carry out those duties, to stay awake, to keep fighting, to doing whatever you were doing?
Just the flow of adrenaline.
Yeah?
Just keeps you moving.
I'm imagining you had never experienced anything quite like that before.
Nope. No. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah. So what were those ensuing days like?
Oh, they tapered off a little bit when the Army kept further in, and the airplanes quit flying over.
Uh-huh.
So it got better, got a little easier to take.
Was it more challenging in the dark than it was during the daytime?
No, more challenging in the daytime.
Why?
You had more Amtraks coming ashore. Amtraks coming back with somebody that's been shot, and they all they want to do is get that bullet out or get that shrapnel out or whatever it is, and then go on. They don't even want to give you their name and their number. I'd get their name and number and turn it over to their officer so their officer could make sure that they followed up with the medics, that they didn't get any kind of infection or whatever, and got properly treated like in a hospital station. And then they put on their record that they'd gotten shot, you know.
Right. So you're helping people go in to battle in advance, but you've also got them coming back wounded. You're processing them. You got them coming and going.
Yeah.
You're a pretty busy guy.
Well, there's not that many.
Were you helping with first aid for some of them too, or
yes,
only yourself? Okay. So you had to help patch up some other guys.
We had a basic medical training.
Uh-huh.
Where we could do minor incisions and stuff like that. We had a kit there. You had to sharpen your knives and everything. It's not like the knives today are disposable.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sharpen them.
Can you give us an example of some of the things you had to do in caring for those wounded soldiers who came back?
Well, one tank driver had gotten off his tank, and he'd gone ashore kind of looking around to see where he was going to go, and he stepped on a landmine. It blew his heel. The whole heel just opened up in his shoe. The heel part just opened up, and he'd come back, and he'd got him back on the tank some way, and he came back, and he wanted to see what he could do. So he got off, and we looked at it, and it just peeled off like your sole under your shoe would peel off. And I opened it up and took the tongue depressors and scraped it out, whatever's in there, in the blood and stuff. And then I put butterfly bandages. We had to make our own because they didn't have them. We made them out of tape, put that all around it, had to cut his shoe off to start with, and then taped his foot up with an ace bandage. And I said, why don't you just lay down here and we'll get somebody to take you back to the ship.
I'm from a farm up in Oregon. He says, I don't need all that kind of stuff. He says, I just get me back on my tank.
So he climbed back on the tank, and away he went.
Wow.
And I had his name and his number, and I gave that to his officer, and so they checked it later. Then about, almost been 40 years later, I was up in Oregon, in Yahats, Oregon, where they have a big campground like. My wife's uncle was there, and we went walking to get the mail. And here comes some guy down the road limping, you know, kind of limping, walking away. He's older than I was. He was probably in his 80s, but then come limping around, and he looks at me, and he's about 100 yards away, but he still sees me, and I hear this guy cussing at me. U.S.O.B., U.S.O.B., you're the one, S.O.B., and my uncle says, what's this? Are we going to get involved in something? I said, I don't know who it is, and I got closer, and he says, you're the S.O.B. that fixed my foot. And so I had to go up and meet his wife, and she was crying. You saved my husband's foot. He said, if it hadn't been for you, he'd have lost his foot. Mm-hmm. I said, well, we do what we have to.
How fulfilling was that for you to see him again and understand how much it meant
good.
To him?
It teared my eyes.
I believe it. It's bringing a little water to your eyes right now.
Yep.
Yeah, and probably a few people out there listening. So that's an example. Really, you're kind of a jack of all trades there on this beach in Okinawa.
Well, I've been lucky.
Uh-huh.
The good Lord blessed me with abilities to do a lot of things.
Including to tell a story no one else could tell. That was George Chrisman. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, a Marine wounded on Okinawa and why he was so thankful that incident happened the way it did. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode today marking 78 years since the start of the Battle of Okinawa, the last major land battle of World War II in the Pacific. Another young American who experienced the intensity of Okinawa firsthand was a Marine carrying the nickname Pluto, Glenn Bram.
We landed there on Easter Sunday, April Fool's Day. It was, April the 1st. Yeah, I was on there a month and a half before I finally got hit. I think I got hit May the 14th.
Wow. That is a long time. So what were you doing for that month and a half?
Gone, moving up in battles. One day you'd run into trouble, then you'd go 3 or 4 days and nothing would happen. Then you'd move up a little further and run into some more opposition.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with, or maybe the most terrifying part of the whole experience for you?
Well, it was all terrifying. but remember they wanted just 3 days before I got shot, they wanted to send me home to go to officer's candidate school. They said they'd ship me out right now. And I says, no, after this was over, I'd be coming home anyway, because after 4 campaigns, they automatically sent you home. And then, so 3 days later, then I got shot.
And this is quite a story. And, you know, you come back and you marry Muriel and you would have 5 children. Now there's 15 grandkids and 32 great-grandkids. And this always amazes me. None of those people would be here if your rifle hadn't jammed. That's crazy.
That's what my kids keep telling me.
Tell me what happened. Your rifle jammed?
Yeah.
Where was the situation? Where were you and what was going on?
They had sent 2 squads of us in. There was some of the guys, another outfit, were trapped in this little valley. And they sent us in. And we could see them getting picked off down there. So I said, boy, I, no way are we going to, I won't take my squad down. It was just then it says, Pluto, get ready, you're going down there. So you have to do it. So they sent a tank in with us. So we were behind the tank going up this little valley, and a mortar shell came in and hit right on the turret of the tank and put that out of commission. So I was right behind it. And when my rifle jammed, I bent over to fix it, and just then it felt like somebody hit me with their fist in the shoulder. And I lay in blood blowing all over, so I knew what happened. So about that time, everybody was getting hit. In fact, the other squad leader got hit with the same bullet that I got hit with. When it exploded, a chunk of it broke his arm.
Wow.
And right after that, we had this one platoon sergeant that was with us. He sent me a picture of himself after he got home. He got hit right through the mouth. It looked like a dimple on each side. It didn't hit a tooth or his tongue or anything.
Wow, what are the odds of that?
And that all happened just within a few minutes, and finally they sent smoke shells in and told us to go back. So you couldn't see anything from here to you, always getting out of that smoke. So we headed back, and I jumped in a shell hole because I got grazed in the arm, but just out of the smoke, a bullet hit me in the arm, and it hit my cartridge belt, and then I dove in the shell hole, and I dove in on my right side because this one was hurt. And I broke two ribs, which I didn't know till afterwards, but I broke two ribs. And there were two guys in the hole, and they were two of the ones that we had gone in to try to get out. And they poured sulfa in my shoulder and everything and helped me get up to the top of the ridge. And then they took me back to the medical center then. But by that time, I had lost a lot of blood. I don't know how many pints of blood they gave me.
Yeah.
But I was still able to walk.
Well, I want to hear more about that, but I want to underscore for people, because they might be saying, well, wait a second. You said if his rifle hadn't jammed, he wouldn't be here. Well, the implication is if you're not bending over to fix that rifle, you're standing up and the shell hits you where?
It would right in the back or the shoulder. I mean,
it would have just blown you in half.
Oh, yeah. Because I still get pieces that work out, like little pimples coming. I've got, I don't know how many pieces still in my neck.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. But it would have killed you. There's no question.
Oh, yeah,
you
wouldn't absolutely be here. Oh, that's right.
So it's a good thing that rifle jammed. But then, so now your shoulder's blown to bits. You dive in the hole. You crack two ribs. You can still walk, but you've lost all this blood. I mean, you've got to be just out of your mind. I can't imagine what was going on.
Yeah. Well, I was just happy to get back to the aid station anyway, and then they worked on me. I can remember the doctor asking me if I wanted to save some of those pieces coming out. I could hear him as he was dropping them in a can. I said, no, I don't want them. I did say, is this going to be enough to get me home? He says, it will. Don't worry about it.
Wow. How long of a process was that for you to recover?
Well, I was, I got hit May the 14th. I got home June the 14th. I'd been in the hospital in Guam for a week and then in Pearl Harbor for another couple of weeks. And then I was in the hospital at Pleasanton for a couple of weeks afterwards. But after that, I was able to take care of it myself. But it was such a hole, they couldn't stitch it. They had to use clamps to clamp it together because the stitches kept popping. So it left a pretty good hole.
And I imagine your parents found out when you got hit. They probably got a telegram or something?
They didn't. I wrote and told them that I'd gotten hit and I was coming home, so don't worry about me. They didn't... I was home on a furlough when they got the information that I had gotten hit.
You mean you saw them before they knew that you were wounded?
Well, I told them I was wounded, but...
Okay, so you told them in person before letter actually arrived.
On a letter, I told them that I was wounded.
Yeah.
I did that when I was in Pearl Harbor.
Oh, I get it. Okay. This might be a tough one to answer because I get the sense that there's not a lot that slows you down. But there's got to be some kind of lasting impact of an injury that severe that basically blows off the top of your left shoulder.
Well, I can't raise my arm too high. I mean, that.
Yeah.
When I got discharged, they said, do you want to stay around for a medical discharge? And I said, how long will that take? Well, they don't know. I said, if I can get out now, I'll take it. I'll go now. So they did. They gave me a 20% disability. And I got that for about 2 years. And they called me up and said for another examination to see what it was, and they found out that I should have been getting 40% disability. So they gave me that. It was retroactive, which didn't amount to too much, but it was still quite a bit. So I've been getting that ever since. But I think if I would have stuck around for a medical discharge, I probably could have gotten 50%.
And as far as the way it is today, or for all these years, have you had pain, or it's just kind of limited mobility?
Just limited, but yeah. It bothers my golf swing. I don't have any backswing at all. They tied the tendons too tight, so that's why I can't raise my arm too high.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't bother me that bad.
So you were already home when Japan surrendered?
Yeah, I was home on a furlough.
What was that like for you after every? I mean, you've been at some pretty significant battles against these guys.
Well, I remember my cousin and I went deer hunting. As soon as it was over, we took off, went up to the ranch deer hunting for the weekend. Everybody was celebrating in town, and we went off by ourselves deer hunting.
How much have you told your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids about this over the years?
Very little. I mean, once in a while they'll ask me questions, and I'll tell them something, but I just never cared to even talk about it, really.
You were glad to get home and didn't need to live in the past.
That's
huh?
Right, yeah. I worked for the Gilroy Lumber Company about 25 years. I retired when I was 55. I had a stroke. Some friends and I were fishing in Idaho, and I had a stroke there. I was in intensive care for a few days, and finally my wife and one of my sons came up, and a son-in-law took a motor home and picked me up and brought me home. But they wondered what caused the stroke. They gave me all kinds of tests when I got home. Just about 2 weeks before I left to go fishing, the doctor cut a piece of shrapnel out of my neck. And when he was cutting, I could feel it clicking in there on my windpipe. I says, "That clicking my wind?" "No," he says, "don't worry about it." He says, "There's a lot of things more important than that." He says, "It's right on the carotid artery." And I think that's what happened when a chunk of something got in that carotid artery afterwards.
Sure.
And that's what caused it.
And you still have pieces of that shrapnel in there.
Yeah.
About how often does one of them work its way to the surface?
Oh, every 6 or 8 months a piece will come out. In fact, my wife pulled one out some years ago. It was just like a little fish hook. And she pulled it out, and it had about an inch piece of my jacket still hanging on the piece of shrapnel.
Your jacket had been under your skin for all those years?
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. When you think back on that time, and obviously this is a lot of nights spent in foxholes, a lot of days in combat, a lot of close calls, that closest call we just heard about. But what are the things that today maybe you still think about and say, you know, somebody was really looking out for me there, or I'm really proud of how I handled that there?
Well, it's a sense somebody was looking out for me, that's for sure. As far as handling things, the one thing that started me off right, when I first went overseas, we went to Wellington, New Zealand, for replacements for the 2nd Division after Guadalcanal. So some of the guys that were on Guadalcanal were with us. We were getting ready to go to Tarawa. And this one sergeant told me, he says, when you land, make sure you don't go out. When they drop the ramp down, don't go out, go over the side of the boat. He says, if they have a machine gun trained on that ramp, it'll get everybody. So he says, go over the side. Mm. Well, I did. I didn't know how deep the water was, and I couldn't swim. But anyway, it was only up over my chest a little bit. But I remember that's something that probably helped me, just what he told me there.
Sure. You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was the question I was going to ask you that I forgot. With not being able to swim, was there ever a point during your time in the service where you thought that was going to be your undoing, where you found yourself in a situation?
I thought that might have been, but I was lucky enough. We were in close enough. In fact, I came in under a pier right afterwards. There was a little pier there, and I came in under that. But some of the ones behind me, they just drowned right there.
Mm-hmm. What are you most proud of with regard to your time in the Marine Corps?
I'm just proud to be a Marine, I guess, that's for sure. I mean, it was a good outfit.
Do you have some pride based on what collectively 16 million Americans in the armed forces and all the people back at home supporting them, what you were able to accomplish?
What bothers me are the ones that came back from Vietnam and Korea with the treatment they got. I didn't think that was right. I mean, we didn't get treated that way when we got home. We got treated as heroes, which the heroes are the dead ones, really.
More than 12,000 Americans gave their lives on Okinawa during World War II, a battle that began 78 years ago this weekend. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, another Okinawa Marine shares his experiences in battle as well as an unforgettable encounter that would stir emotions for the rest of his life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing today on the Battle of Okinawa, which began 78 years ago this weekend on April 1st, 1945. Another teenage Marine whose life was forever changed in that battle was Dale Anderson.
We were in the 62nd replacement draft when we went over, and they were needing we heard later that 9 out of 10 of us that were going over in those replacement drafts were being killed at the time. But they left us on Guam for about 30 days, and then we headed on toward Okinawa.
Now, before we get to Okinawa, you mentioned 9 out of 10 being killed, and at this point, I mean, you're in the Marine Corps, and I'm sure you've heard about what's happened to the Marines at places like Tarawa or Guam or Iwo Jima, even more close to what was happening then. Was that intimidating? Did that cause some fear in you, knowing what could happen to you?
Yes, it caused fear, but it kind of also gave us more determination to go get the job done.
All that price that had already been paid in this war, that it wouldn't be worth anything if you guys didn't finish the job? Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's right. That's what we were thinking, yes.
So what did you know about this place called Okinawa?
Not a thing. Not a thing, except that it was well fortified. We had heard that, but we didn't know much. About a day before we got to Okinawa, a kamikaze plane came at our ship. The Navy and the Marines always kind of jaw back and forth against one another, but I always really liked to hand it to the Navy boys because they were able to shoot that kamikaze plane out of the air, and it landed about a block from our ship. Otherwise, probably I wouldn't be telling this story.
And by this time, the kamikaze phenomenon had been practiced for a while by the Japanese, so you guys knew what that plane's intent was. Did you actually see it heading for the ship?
Oh, yes, we sure did. I sure did. Yes, I saw it heading for the ship. And that was a pretty scary moment for us. But we were so rejoicing, and a cheer went up through the whole ship when they were able to shoot it down so it didn't get our plane. It landed in the ocean and then blew up as it landed. So I was really thankful for that.
And that's a lot closer call than most of us can relate when it comes to military experiences, but you were in for some more close calls once you hit land there at Okinawa. Tell us about coming onto that island and what you encountered.
The northern half of the island was secured, and we landed toward the southern half of the island. Naha City was one of the big cities that was there close. As we came in the LST boats, he didn't get quite far enough in the shore, I guess because of the coral reef. But in a way, as I stepped off of the edge of the boat, of course, I had my pack and my weapon, and I sank all the way under. I could not touch the ground, and had it not been for a couple of big 6'4" guys catching me under each arm and taking me in about 20 feet before I could even touch the ground, I'd have probably died right out there before I even got into battle. But we didn't take any fire as we were going in on the beach, but they loaded us in trucks and started taking us inland because the battle was raging inland. As we just kind of started out down this dirt road, kind of going uphill, I looked over the side and I saw just a half of a body laying in the trench from the rib cage up. And we had a sergeant with us, Sergeant Ferguson, that had been over there before. This was his second tour. And I said, "Sarge, I just saw a piece of a body laying there." And he said, "You're going to see a lot of those from here on in." And he was right. Before we went in another probably mile, it was just getting dusk, and there must have been at least 20 of those half of bodies. It seemed like that the Japanese, when they were knew they were going to be captured, they would blow themselves up, and that was because of those bodies laying along there. And they took us in that night, and they bedded us down under about 8 or 10 10-inch guns, big guns, booming all night long. And they bedded us down under there, and they said, "You don't move from here tonight. If you got to go to the bathroom, just roll over and go. But if you get out of your sacks, you're liable to get shot before morning." And so we stayed close. We didn't get much sleep, but that was when we went in on Okinawa there.
And shot not by the Japanese, but by your own guys, thinking maybe you were Japanese coming into your camp. So you're 18 years old. You're on this island halfway across the world from where you grew up, and you've seen pieces of bodies everywhere. You're hearing these booming guns. What are you thinking that night as you try to get some sleep?
I was thinking, I sure hoped we had good guards that was standing guard duty, because every once in a while, you'd hear of a guard going to sleep. So I couldn't really sleep soundly, and I still don't, because I was always afraid that a guard might go to sleep and instead of standing his post.
So that was the first night. You've seen some of the effects of this battle, of this war that cost so many lives worldwide, but you haven't experienced it all firsthand just yet. I imagine you didn't have to wait very long.
No, I think the next night or two, as we marched on in from there, one night, in fact, that's what I got the sword here from the souvenir, we were in our foxholes, and we had heard that the Japanese were going to make a banzai attack on our unit. We thought we were ready, but just about dawn, we heard them making a lot of noise. They were getting all doped up and everything. They tell us that they got, I don't know what kind of dope they used, but they got dope where they couldn't feel much pain. But they came at us with their swords hollering, "Banzai, Banzai." And, of course, we were started firing at them. And I wasn't aiming. I was just firing from the hip at this one big the Japanese were big on Okinawa. They were big Marines. But anyway, I kept firing. I thought somebody had maybe given me blanks for my weapon because he wasn't falling like he should have. But finally, he fell right at the edge of my foxhole, and I got his sword here laying on the table. But that was a scary time. We did repel the whole Japanese unit there, kill most of them, but they were pushed back.
How difficult was that? To go through that experience as a teenager?
It was very difficult back then, but it brings back, it brings back tears to my eyes now, because when I think about it and think how close I come to getting my head lopped off there, and some of the other guys that got killed, none of them got their heads taken off, but some of them were killed with the swords. But it is difficult, but it's so important that we pass this history on, so hopefully we never have another war like we had back then, or any war, for that matter of fact. history is so important to our younger generation.
If you can, put yourself in your mind then as an 18-year-old. How did you get beyond that the next day? Because that's enough to weigh someone down and really cripple them with just the weight of what was happening there. What do you think it was that helped you get through it and get on to another day?
Well, looking back on it, I think it was God that was directing and guiding this, even though I didn't know Christ at the time, but he brought me through it. But it was hard. I remember one morning we were going to chow. The mess hall was up on the hill. The island was almost secured at the time. I was passing by this small two-man tent, and I heard this explosion. One of my good buddies came crawling out on his hands and knees out of the tent, and there was a stream of blood about the size of your index finger shooting out his right temple. Every time his heart would beat, it would just psh. And, of course, he died there in just a matter of seconds. And the other fella, named Gil Belcher, he was about 6'6" tall, and he came out of the tent all bent over, but he was running and screaming. And he just ran in a big circle out, and the guys had to catch him to hold him down. I thought that they had been playing with a landmine, and it went off. But that's not the case. One of them was cleaning his rifle, and as he pushed down to putting his rifle back together, he pushed down on a landmine, and that's what exploded. And he had like 170 pieces of shrapnel. He lived, but he got to come home, but he lived through it. But I didn't go on to breakfast. It made me sick at my stomach when I saw that blood pouring out of his head there, so it just spoiled my appetite that day. The island had a lot of big caves. There was a lot of bags of black powder ammo left around from that, and as we would go out on patrol, one day we were walking down this dirt road, and there was sugar cane on each side of the road. Sugar cane was up about 5 feet high, and we would always walk about 8 feet apart in case somebody lobbed a grenade over into our ranks. It wouldn't kill that many. One day, this Sergeant Ferguson, he carried a 30 caliber carbine. He just turned and fired, and about a few seconds after he fired, we heard this thud. Just after we heard the thud, here came pieces of blood and guts and everything and landed on us. And we didn't realize what had happened real soon, but Fergie said a Japanese had raised up, ready to throw a grenade over in our ranks, and that's when he saw him and he shot him. The Japanese fell, and when he fell, his grenade went off, and that's what threw that blood and guts all up around over us. We went on down from there, this same sergeant, now where it was grass on each side of the road, high grass, about almost 3 feet high, and there was a dry canal running down along, and there was a big willow tree down on the side of that. As we approached that willow tree, Fergie just turned and fired in the grass, again with his 30 caliber. He had sharp eyes, but he turned and fired, and a woman fell out. He had shot her right down through the top of the head. All he saw was black hair. At the time he shot, he didn't know it was a woman, but he shot her right down to the top of the head, and the bullet came out her left cheek, blew it out. And just almost immediately after that, two big Japanese was running down this dry canal. Of course, they were both killed almost immediately. Then we went up to the tree and went down, and there was a cave about 3 or 4 feet in diameter. And if you came to a cave that had flies flying around the mouth of it, you knew it was occupied. We had a Okinawan that was friendly to us that we took along as an interpreter. So we sent him into the cave to see if there was anybody in there to try to get him to surrender and come out. And in just a little bit, this old grandma, she must have been 80 or better, and about a 10-year-old girl came out. Of course, they both had their hands up. The little 10-year-old girl had this little doll in her hand. And she bowed and she held out the doll to me. And I made the motion that I didn't want it, but she did it again, so I took this little doll, and I've had it all these years. They were sent to a repatriation holding camp, but it's hard memories.
When you saw a grandmother and a little girl handing you a doll, did that alter your perspective or put more of a human face on what was going on there on Okinawa?
We knew they couldn't hurt us, or we didn't think they could hurt us, so we were sympathetic toward them because we figured it was probably a whole family that had been wiped out that day. This was probably the grandmother, and the first lady that Fergie killed was probably the mama of the little girl, and then the two that was running down the ditch that got killed, they were probably her sons or her brother. And so it was a whole family that was probably wiped out that day. That's just hard when you think back on it.
Yeah, it seems like that's part of the explanation of what you said earlier, that you hope there's never another war like the one you guys were in.
Yes, sure is.
So this Battle of Okinawa, the last major land battle of World War II, did you have any kind of inkling when it was winding down that things might be over for you soon?
No, we were still, we were preparing for mainland Japan, and we were all dreading that battle. Even though we were Marines, we were dreading the Battle of mainland Japan because the way Iwo Jima had been fortified and Okinawa had been fortified, we knew mainland Japan was going to be really, really bad. I always had to hand it to President Truman at the time for making the hard decision to drop the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That was a mighty hard decision he had to make.
By mid-August, Japan is surrendering, and you guys don't have to go over there, and I imagine you Marines celebrated just a little bit.
Yeah, we celebrated a lot with some Japanese sake. One kind of fun thing that we had, it was July, the island was secured, so I had brought in a bag of this black powder with granules about the size of your index fingernail. I decided I'd have a little fun. Of course, we were drinking a little sake at the time, too.
This wasn't just being stupid. You knew how to work with black powder from your days blowing up giant trees in the forest for lumber back before the war, right?
That's right. Yes, that's we did. I'd had some experience with black powder and dynamite. And we used to buy our dynamite from a place there in Orange Cove. I think the little building is still there where they kept the dynamite out back.
So when the 4th of July rolls around on Okinawa, you want to celebrate like all your fellow Americans back home. You find some black powder. What kind of fireworks did you produce and how'd you pull it off?
Well, I found a pipe, a 3/4-inch pipe, about 3 feet long. We were bivouacked right along a river there, and so I stuck this end of this pipe down in the edge of the bank, kind of pointed it out over the river, and filled it with black powder, and whittled me out a wooden plug to go in it. But I didn't have a fuse. I didn't have a way to set it off. And it was getting toward dusk. I looked over about 100 feet or so, and we saw a column of gnats about 4 foot high and about a foot around that was just static. And I thought, well, that's strange to hear, to see gnats flying around in a static position. So I said, well, let's go investigate. So a couple of buddies and I, we went over. It was an old house that had been all blown to pieces. We threw back some boards. Here was a big crock with about an 8-inch mouth on it, and it was almost 3 feet deep, buried in the ground, and of course these gnats were flying right over the top of that. And I got to thinking, well, I know gnats like vinegar, so maybe it's a jug of vinegar. So I took my canteen cup and dipped down in it and smelled of it. Don't smell too bad. So I tasted of it. Ooh, it even tastes even better. So it was a whole jug of Japanese sake. So I filled both canteens. Of course, the canteens were aluminum back then. I filled both canteens, went back to camp, tore off a piece of my shirt, dipped it down in it, stuck it down in the pipe, let the end of it come over and stuck a match to it, and it burnt down in that black powder, and those big granules of black powder came out over that river just real pretty, nice.
Lit up the sky?
Lit up the sky. And I was getting ready to load up again. I kind of looked down by where the pipe was, and I saw these two shoes, they must have been size 14 or 16. They were, I think, the biggest boots I'd ever seen. And I slowly looked up, And it was a captain, and he said, "Anderson, what are you trying to do?" And I said, "Oh, just have a little fun, sir. It's 4th of July." And he said, "Your fun is over." He said, "We thought we were under, the officers were bivouacked upon the hill." And he said, "We thought we were under attack again, so you quit that." So the next day, we were out on patrol, and I decided I'd have a drink of water out of my canteen that I'd filled last night. And so as I pulled that aluminum canteen out of the canteen cup, the whole bottom of that canteen came off. It was just disintegrated from that Japanese sake. And so you can imagine what it would do to your stomach.
The memories of Okinawa we heard today run the gamut from the lighthearted to the gut-wrenching. More than 12,000 Americans made the ultimate sacrifice in that 83-day battle. Nearly 40,000 more were wounded. Go to hometownheroesradio.com to link to the complete original interviews with the three veterans you heard from today, not to mention many others who participated in the Battle of Okinawa, which began, again, 78 years ago this weekend. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.